All right, we are in First Peter chapter 4. This is what it looks like to see a man adjusting the height of a pulpit. I'm finished now. And let's look together at First Peter chapter 4, what suffering hopes for. This is actually the second of two sermons of the same title. We're now in the very heart of this letter. This letter written by Peter, an actual apostle, to an actual group of people who he addressed as elect exiles. We saw this last week again. The title of the Peter's title for the people reading this letter indicates that they are people of a great privilege. They are the elect of God, the chosen of God. But people living in great difficulties. They were scattered as aliens throughout the world. They were exiles. And the theme of the letter wraps around that title. But here are the people who ought to have it made because they are so privileged to be the chosen of God. And they looked to be living in the very lowest part of their ladder, so to speak. They were suffering beyond the suffering of many people around them. Their lives were raising questions in their minds and the minds of others, which is the question of suffering, especially suffering when you deliberately have avoided doing wrong and the wrong thing and have deliberately chosen to do right. And when that choice leads to your suffering, it raises questions in the mind of a person who, for example, has made the decision to follow God. Believing that God is all-powerful and all-good, you would think that as soon as you make the right decision to follow Him, everything would start getting fixed. And in fact, sometimes that's how it happens. But it wasn't happening for the elect exiles, and their decision to follow Christ is what was causing them the suffering, because they were living in the 60s, the original 60s, the 60s of the first century. And persecution was breaking out as the Roman Empire was turning on the Christian church. And Peter knew all about that, and he had his own suffering ahead of him. And he writes this letter to these people who are going through suffering, especially suffering for doing what's right. And he speaks to them of what to hope for. Now, Peter is often called the Apostle of Hope, and it mostly has to do with this book, this letter, that he was called that, because the word hope pops up in some very critical and pivotal points in the letter. He was a person of hope. And he did not want the Christians around him, the Christians reading his letter, to be hopeless. He wanted them to be hopeful, though they were suffering. So he's writing them about what to hope for during their times of suffering. And we got to the heart of the letter last week, second part of chapter 3, and now we are concluding the heart of the letter with all of chapter 4. And I think what we're seeing is, well, what we looked at last week, it is phrased very succinctly in chapter 3, verse 14. This is kind of the key verse of the entire letter, chapter 3, verse 14. Even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. And it's the blessing which Peter is focusing attention upon to hope for. We saw last week a couple of things that suffering Christians should hope for. One is that all of this suffering, whatever it is, whatever the circumstances are, is all being used by God for our holiness. So the series on 1 Peter we're calling Holy Hopes. Our primary hope is that God is at work in our lives to make us holy people, to make us like Christ. And the circumstances of life are not beside the point, but are pointing to God's plan to make us holy. The second thing that suffering can hope for, we saw last week, is that the same thing that God is doing in our lives through our bad circumstances, He will do in other people's lives through our bad circumstances. That our suffering has a significant positive impact upon other people, especially if we shine like brilliant lights, as we will, if we are hopeful while we are suffering. Just at the point where people start feeling sorry for us, if they get to see how hopeful we are, how confident we are about the future, we are suddenly set up to speak words of truth. And if not to speak them, at least to live out the truth so that people might learn what we have been learning about trusting God. And speaking of trusting God, this fourth chapter, which is really the core of the letter and the conclusion of this summary of the theme, ends with verse 19, where Peter says, therefore, and this word, which obviously refers to something before, I think refers to everything he's written up until now. This is sort of a concluding statement of the whole idea of suffering. He says, therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will and trust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Just keep doing good, and so entrust your souls to God as you suffer according to His will. So we have two notes this morning, and both have to do with this idea from verse 19 of entrusting our souls to God. We're talking today about really, really trusting God. which ought not to be a novel idea to the people who call themselves Christians, because we need to live by faith, and faith is how you get in on Christianity. Faith is the thing that we all have in common. Faith is trusting yourself to God. But anyone who claims to have faith, like many of us do, that explains what we're doing here of all places on a Sunday morning. Anyone who makes a claim to faith ought to notice a question in his or her mind. And the question is, really? Am I really a person of faith? Am I really trusting God? Have I really entrusted myself to God? See, trust is like an ability. It's like a strength. It's like something you can do with your muscles, except that you haven't any muscle to look at. You know, if you've been doing your push-ups, you can show somebody your arms and say, look at that, whoa. And they can feel your tricep and say, whoa, yeah, it's really strong arms. I bet you can do 10 push-ups. Well, no, but I'm working on it. 9 so far. But when it comes to trusting God, there's nothing to squeeze. There's nothing to look at to see that it's strong. Your ability to trust is totally invisible. Invisible to you. Totally intangible. Nobody can touch it, not even you. So there's room for a little bit of uncertainty, isn't there? There's a room for guessing. I guess my faith is real. I guess I really trust God. There's a couple of notes about entrusting our souls to God this morning that are necessary notes and details that help us to answer the question that comes to mind, should come to mind, whenever we or anyone else claims to be truly a person of faith. And it's a really important question to get the right answer to. Because in fact, so much of your life as a Christian, maybe all of your life as a Christian, comes down to this thing, a faith, and whether you really are a person of faith. Because you could be faking it. You could certainly be faking each other. You could be faking the people around you. Some of you may know you're doing that. You're just going through the motions. There's some classic times of life to do that. You could be not pointing fingers at anyone, but you could be living at home with your parents and in your late teens and looking forward to getting out and just keeping the boat from rocking by pretending to be a believer, though you don't really think you believe any of it. And soon you can get away from home and maybe out of town and into a university residence or, you know, whatever. I'm not thinking of anybody specifically, honest. I'm just talking. And think, once I'm out on my own, then, you know, I'll find out what I believe. And maybe you already know you don't really believe what your parents believe. And that's just one of the many stages of life where you could find yourself quite deliberately faking it. In a way, more dangerous is a person who's faking it but doesn't really realize it. You're experiencing positive peer pressure. You're around people who believe, so it's just easy to go with the flow and say the things they say and act like a believer, and maybe you do it so well that you've convinced yourself. And I don't mean to make anyone paranoid. Maybe you really do believe. I'm sure many of us do. But just as sure that some of us might be faking it. So what does it really mean to do what Peter calls us to in verse 19? Let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to God. Well, there's a couple notes on the point, so let's look. Here's what real faith looks like. Note number one about really trusting God. Entrusting our souls to God requires us to manage our thinking. This we get from the verses we're looking at this morning. There's a strong call to take control of your mind. Don't let your mind just go off in any direction. Take control of it. When Peter talks about entrusting our souls to a faithful Creator while doing good, one of the good things we must do is take control of our minds. So we see in verse 1, since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. A certain way of thinking is like armor that will protect your mind, so your life, from all kinds of bad influences. But you've got to arm yourself. You've got to take on this way of thinking. And what he's talking about here is suffering in the flesh so as to cease from sin. Now, these first 6 verses of chapter 4 are the second most controversial section of the letter, and they follow close on the heels of the most controversial section, which we looked at last week, that whole business about Christ after the resurrection, going and proclaiming to the spirits in prison during the days when the ark was being built, all of that. And we saw last week what we need to see here. that to understand, I think to understand what Peter's getting at here, and to understand that he's not saying something really contrary to what the rest of the Bible says about the gospel, you've got to see that Peter has an almost unique way of talking about the flesh and the spirit. And when he talks about in the flesh, what I think he means is here in space and time, here in this reality, this tangible reality. So to suffer in the flesh, what Peter's saying here is what he's been saying all along, to suffer in this reality, to suffer in life. And those who suffer in this life, he says, have ceased from sin. He's not coming up with some new theory of sanctification, though sanctification or holiness is the topic. He's just saying what he's been saying all along, which is why there's no extra explanation of his terms. He's just saying, you make a decision to do the right thing, even though it's going to hurt, that's suffering in the flesh. That's suffering in this world for the sake of doing what's right. But if you've done that, if you make that decision to go ahead and do something that's painful because it's the right thing to do, you've ceased from sin. Because sin so often is caused by saying, woo, won't do that, that would hurt, so you don't do the right thing. Or, woo, I'm going to do that because that would feel good, and you do the wrong thing. So Peter's simply saying you've got to be willing to suffer in the flesh in order to do the right thing. But to make that decision, to manage your thinking so as to make that decision, is really what entrusting our souls to God is all about. So that's what he's saying here. And what he says continues on right through to verse 7, where again, called to manage our thinking, he says, the end of all things is at hand. Peter had the very strong understanding, and he wasn't wrong. I'll show you in a minute why I think he wasn't wrong, that the end of all things was right at hand for him and the people that were reading the letter. The end of all things is at hand, he says, therefore be self-controlled and sober-minded. Have a controlled mind. Control yourself mentally. Be sober-minded. Don't let the circumstances of life make you giddy, make you like a drunk, but be sober-minded. And he has a specific reason in verse 7 for this necessary management of our thinking. He says, for the sake of your prayers. You won't be able to pray properly if your mind is all over the place. You need to focus your mind. You need to be self-controlled in your thinking for the sake of your prayers. And of course, praying is all about entrusting our souls to God, right? When you really want to be sure that you're entrusting your soul to God, an obvious thing to do is to pray and to talk to God about what you're entrusting Him, what you're trusting Him for. So in order to do that kind of praying that's involved in entrusting your soul to God, you've got to manage your thinking. And managing your thinking is not a new idea. It's been through this whole letter. Remember chapter 1, verse 13, Peter said, therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. In order to keep your hope focused on Jesus Christ and the grace that He will bring, you've got to be sober-minded. Same word. And we will see next chapter, Lord willing, a couple of weeks from now, verse 8 of chapter 5, in regard to what we call these days spiritual warfare, what we know as the battle we have with the devil. Peter says, chapter 5, verse 8, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. And in regard to the devil's intentions to devour someone, we need to be very careful with our thoughts. We need to be sober-minded and be watchful. But what Peter's got in mind right here is that we need to manage our thinking in regard to our suffering for righteousness' sake. So we get to verse 12 where he says, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. And that next little chapter of the letter, verses 12 to 16, is all about that. About how you need to manage your thinking in regard to what your brain says to you and what thoughts come to your mind when you begin to suffer specifically for doing what's right. You've got to manage your thinking. Don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though some strange thing were happening to you. You know, manage your thinking about the tough times you're going through. So, you know, if you're going through tough times, if you're now the person that your friends are feeling sorry for because of some health challenge or because of some relationship issue or some financial issue, some people come alongside and say, oh, here you're going through a tough time. That's so bad. That's too bad. We need to be really careful at that point to manage our thinking well, because bad thinking about our suffering will cause or prompt bad thinking in the minds of the people who are just coming alongside to console us. And it's good that they want to console us, but we shouldn't confuse them, so we mustn't be confused. So you don't want to say something. Someone consoles you for your hardships, especially suffering for the sake of righteousness. You don't want to say something confusing. You don't want to say, yeah, sheesh, it's crazy, isn't it, man? I tried the right thing, and sometimes I think there is no God. You don't want to say something like that. Even if it's assumed as a joke, you want to say something that is clear so that the people that are listening to you will be enlightened rather than confused. You want to sound hopeful. You want to sound confident in God. Now, we saw last week how we understand that some of the good that comes from suffering is for our own holiness, and then we also saw that it can contribute to the holiness of others. But there's a third thing that we should be looking for, a third thing that suffering should hope for, and you get to it in this little section, verse 16, which is a really interesting verse for the quirky reason that this is one of the few places in the New Testament where the word Christian is used. Peter says, yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. And here's the third thing suffering hopes for. But let him glorify God in that name. The third thing that suffering hopes for is that while we are suffering, we are being positioned to bring great glory to God. So Peter says, if you suffer as a Christian, don't be ashamed of the name Christian, but glorify God in that name. And the backstory on this, you got to understand, is the origin of the word Christian, which was meant as a title of ridicule when it was invented. We didn't invent it. That is, Christians didn't invent it. They invented it. Christians called themselves people of the way, disciples of Christ, followers of Jesus. They had terms like that. But the people looking at Christians, before they were called Christians, wanting to make fun of their allegiance to Christ, invented a little term in Greek, Christianos, a little term which means Christlings, Christlets. It was meant to make fun of us. And the Christians just sort of observed the insult, realized that the name of the Lord was being taken in vain, and we were being ridiculed for following him. And then they started thinking about it, and they started liking it. Yeah, yeah. Put me down as a Christlet. Put me down as a Christling. Put me down like that. And in getting used to the insult, they were doing exactly what Peter was saying in verse 16. If you suffer as a Christian, if you suffer as a Bible-thumping Jesus freak, that would be the sort of sense. If you suffer for being one of those Jesus people, don't be ashamed, but glorify God. Say, it is my great delight to be thought of as a little follower of Christ. Huge honor to be called a Christian. And they've picked up the insult that was cast at them until now, thousands of years later, we don't even think of it that way. But it's a instance of right thinking. It's an instance of managing our thinking, and we all need to become good at it. Becoming good at managing our thinking is a sign, a very helpful sign, that you really are entrusting your soul to God, that you're in it for real. So there's a note that helps us answer the big question of whether or not we really are people of faith. And it leads to another note, which is all part of the need for managing our thinking. So note two from the text, entrusting our souls to God obligates us to love one another. So when we're seeking to entrust our souls to God while doing good, some of the good is the good we have to do to others. And while we're working on managing our thinking the right way while suffering, we need to remember the people around us and our obligation to love one another. And the word one another is used three times in the next few verses, always meaning other Christians, other followers of Jesus. So you get verse 8, and the need to manage our thinking while fulfilling our obligations to one another. Peter says, above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. And here the right thinking that's attached to the obligation is what it means to love earnestly. I mean, it's so easy to just say, hey, love ya, and then get on with our day. But to figure out how to really love one another requires some thought management. So what really needs to be done for that person? What have I got that I could give? So to love one another earnestly requires that we love one another. And not only how we love, but why we love one another, Peter gives an answer that requires thought management. Love covers a multitude of sins. Now here's a phrase that could be grossly misused, so let me clarify if I can. love covers a multitude of sins does not mean whenever someone sins, just love them, period. Because there are some sins that must not be covered, at least not yet. Some sins are so dangerous, some sins are so damaging, some sins are so illegal, some sins are so likely to bring disgrace to the name of Christ that they need to be dealt with, ought not to be covered. Manage your thinking here. The loving thing is to not cover the sin, but to deal with it. So cases of church discipline, or for that matter, cases of courtroom law enforcement, crime and punishment is sometimes the necessary loving thing to do. But hey, we sin in a lot of different ways. And some of our sins towards one another will never make headlines, and yet need to be talked about. So there's some sins that you don't talk to the authorities about, you know, you don't call the cops when a person has insulted you. But it's bad for your relationship to just let her go. It's bad for you to cover your own insulting speech towards someone that you've spoken to badly. So there, the loving thing to do is go and do the hard work of talking about the wrong that went on between the two of you. But we all have lots of ways of sinning and offending one another. And in a long-term relationship, like a parent and child relationship, or like a marriage, or like church life, there's a lot of times when, you know, we are clumsy with each other. When we say the worst thing at the worst time and hurt each other's feelings. And yeah, there's times when it needs to be talked about. But there are times when it would be better to just keep on going. And how do you keep on going when you're the one who's just been clumsily insulted? When someone says something to you that really hurts, but you don't think there's any point in slowing down progress of the relationship or of the project or whatever's going on to stop and talk about it now. Well, Peter says, you know, manage your thinking here. There are times when you should just love one another. Someone says the rudest thing to you or lets you down in a really stinging way. And here's something you could do. Just love the person. Just go ahead and be loving. Love enough to forgive even though it hasn't been repented of. Sometimes that would be a disaster, but not this time. Just go ahead and love the person. Just go ahead and love. And love will cover that sin. And in a church, like for example this one, there's a multitude of sins that we could just roll over. We could just cover up. It'll all get worked out one day. And you can choose to believe the best. You can choose to say, if he knew how much that hurt, he would have said it to me. I'm sure he wouldn't have. And I don't think I'll even bother telling him. I probably said something like that to him yesterday. Just let love cover a multitude of sins. Well, it takes some thinking to work that through. So you've got to manage your thinking because you've got obligations to keep loving one another earnestly. And that's not all. He says in Acts verse, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. And when he talks about showing hospitality, he's talking about the love in the action of meeting needs. Someone needs a place to stay. Someone needs a bed to sleep in. Someone needs some meals. So show hospitality. Open up your doors to that person and do it without grumbling, which takes thought management. And that's not all. We've all been given gifts. Peter's very simple about gifts. He says basically there's two kinds of spiritual gifts. There's serving gifts and there's speaking gifts. He gives instruction. And he says that each has received a gift. Use it, whether it's a speaking gift or a serving gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's very grace. And calling ourselves good stewards means people who have been given a gift that we are responsible to manage, and that requires thought management as well. We have to think about ourselves accurately. We have to know what we're here for. We have to get good thinking going on about why we are at this church and what we are here to do. And it might be something kind of showy. It might be something kind of humble. But we all ought to manage our thinking about why we're here and sort it out so that we know what we can do so that we can serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. We have obligations to love one another. And we prove to ourselves and to anyone else with eyes to see that we really are entrusting our souls to God when we go ahead and do it, when we go ahead and love earnestly, letting love cover a multitude of little sins, and showing hospitality without grumbling and using our gifts as good stewards of the grace of God. Those are the thoughts, those are the notes about entrusting herself to God that come from this text. And now there's two actions. And the actions are on the same topic. Actions involved in entrusting our souls to God. And here's the first, which comes out of the first note. We need to recognize the attitudes and outlooks that don't belong in the mind of a Christian, in our minds as Christians, and trust God for the strength to change them. To manage our thinking means to change our minds about certain things. And we need to change our minds when we recognize that our attitude is wrong. You know, when we're showing hospitality but with grumbling, our attitude is wrong. When we're picking up on every wrong thing that a person does instead of covering over the sin with love, the attitude is wrong. And we need to change the attitude, and we need to change the outlook. Certainly, if we're grumbling about our suffering, we need to change our outlook. So we need to recognize what attitudes and outlooks don't belong in our minds, and then trust God for the strength to change them. Trust God to supply us with, as Peter says, the strength that God supplies. This is what entrusting our souls to God looks like and is experienced like day to day. So we need to get busy changing our minds. And this is one of the powerful, necessary benefits of being part of an actual church, as opposed to being a casual attender or an occasional visitor. When you're actually part of a church, you know, you've actually landed in a small group and you show up every week and you participate in small group life. You actually found a ministry and you work that ministry earnestly. You get to see other Christians doing their thing. You get to see the effects of their thought management or their lack of thought management. And the examples we set for each other are really, really helpful to us in this action of recognizing what attitudes and outlooks don't belong and then trusting God for the strength to change our attitudes. We can see someone who's suffering as much as we are with an attitude that never occurred to us to show. And we can start doing our best imitation of that person because that person is being the kind of person I mean to be, but I'm not being. And I see that now that I'm working with this person, you see. So church life can really be a good benefit. And if someone, you know, is suffering as much as we're suffering for righteousness' sake and not doing nearly as well, that's a helpful example too. Because it hurries us to the opposite end of the court. You know, if we're grumbling a little bit, and then we're working alongside some, you know, ministry, putting chairs back after the carpet or something, and the person beside us is grumbling even more than we are, we get to see how bad that sounds and realize that we sound a little like that too. And it can sort of hurl us down to the other end of the room, so we try to be a good example of that person, not like that person. We can help each other with this, and we need help because no one can really get an accurate understanding of his or her own attitudes and outlooks. We get a shady view of our attitudes and outlooks, but we see them more clearly when we see them reflected in someone else's behavior or in someone else's behavior, the kind of attitude we should have. So that's an action. That's a thinking management that we're called to if we're going to glorify God in our circumstances, in our difficulties. We need to be asking ourselves, in what ways are my thoughts out of control? In what ways does my mind need to sober up? In what ways am I not thinking like a Christian should be thinking in order to glorify God by my thinking? That's the first action. And the second action comes out of the second note about loving. Here it is. We need to identify our one another obligations and trust God for the strength to meet them. If we know what church we should belong to, for example, West London Alliance Church, then we know what church we should belong to. And belonging to that church associates us with certain people. We ought not to take that as a coincidence. We ought to see the people in our church connections, especially those that we're closely connected to because we're in the same small group or the same ministry team or whatever. We should see those people as deliberately placed by God for our loving. We're there to love those people. We need to identify the people that we're specifically obligated to love and trust God for the strength to meet those obligations. And besides loving one another in a strictly Christian sense, you know, in terms of the strict definition of one another, one Christian to another, there are all kinds of other obvious obligations to love in our own households, in our marriages, in our child-raising or parent relationships, and then in our neighborhoods and then in our offices. We are placed by God in particular positions to love certain people. We need to be really clear about who God has placed in our lives for us to love and then get on with it. Trusting God for the strength to meet those obligations. Trusting God for the strength to love people, especially those who give us lots of practice covering a multitude of sins with love. People who are irritating to work with or to be the parents of or to be married to. We need to be really, really clear in the fact that these are not accidental hassles, but these are deliberate designs of God, like the suffering of the martyrs was designed by God to enhance the holiness of the people suffering and to have an impact on the people around them and to glorify God. We need to identify who it is that God has placed us in positions to love and then trust Him for the power to love those people. And you know what that looks like? What entrusting your soul in regard to the loving obligation looks like. It's getting a clear picture of who to love, then some clear picture of what that means, and then just go do it. Do your best imitation of you as a more loving person than you presently are, and trust God to fill in the blanks, to inflate the muscles that are required to do the work that needs to be done to show earnest love. What we have in the concluding part of chapter 4 is a serious note that this is serious business, and it was serious for Peter. Peter wrote in verse 7, the end of all things is at hand. And he writes in verse 17, for it's time for judgment to begin. And it begins with the household of God, he says. What he's talking about here is not a 2,000-year blip in his thinking. You know, if you're pretty convinced by what you see in the headlines that the end of the world is near, well then, you got your hunch. But the Apostle Peter had the same hunch. And he wasn't out by at least 2,000 years. Because the end he was thinking about, I'm sure, is the end that Jesus spoke to him and the other apostles about so clearly. The end of the old covenant. The end of the temple worship of God. The end of Jerusalem being the geographic place in which God can be found. The covenant had been brought to a conclusion by the death of Christ. Jesus said that within one generation of that event, so like within the next 40 years after the resurrection, all the prophecies about the conclusion of the old covenant would come to pass, and the temple would be torn down. And they were running out of years. This was the 60s. As an actual historical fact, the temple was torn apart, block by block, in the year 70. And what got it torn apart by the Roman armies was the Roman emperor, Nero, going crazy and declaring war on the Christians and the Jews at the same time, though they began to be seen as different groups in the 60s. And the war of the Jews was the outcome. And the destruction of Jerusalem and the ruin of the destruction of the temple and the ruin of Jerusalem was what happened next. Well, Peter wasn't wrong when he said the end of all things is at hand and it's time for judgment to begin. He was right. Of course he was right. He was an apostle. He was writing the Bible. He wasn't wrong by 2,000 years. We're wrong to think that he was referring to something that's still future to us. He was talking about something that was imminent to them. And because it was imminent to them, it was really important that the people he was writing to got on their game and started living the life that God was calling them to live. So Peter says, it's time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And then he quotes from the Proverbs, and if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? And he's referring to the fact that before the temple was destroyed and the nation of Israel was basically exterminated by the destruction of the old covenant, the Christians would be persecuted. The Christians were now the household of God, and they were going to go through some fierce persecution under Nero in the 60s. Then Nero commits suicide in 68, and then the Roman Empire changes hands, and the next emperor up gets the war of the Jews heated up, and Jerusalem is destroyed, and you can read it for yourself in the history books. Google it. Destruction of Jerusalem. It was just about to happen. And there's a really bittersweet detail to Peter talking about the judgment that begins with the household of God, meaning begins with the Christians. Because Peter, as you remember, was promised by Jesus that before his time in the flesh was over, he would be put to death by crucifixion. It's in the Gospel of John that it's recorded, but Peter lived for the 40 years up until his death with the knowledge that whatever he did to serve God, however faithfully he loved one another and did all the things he was obligated to do, according to the prophecy of Jesus, he would die by crucifixion. Here's a man who was seeking to glorify God as a Christian. So he says with real seriousness, it's time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if the righteous is scarcely saved, then what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? If the suffering for righteousness, which is the lot of the Christian, is a reality, what will the suffering for the people who do unrighteousness be? With all of that in mind, with his own death by torture in mind, he gives us what we call verse 19. Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Go ahead, he says. Whatever the prospects are, whatever your present suffering is, whatever your future suffering might be, go ahead and entrust your soul to God. Entrust yourself entirely to God. And that's the call upon us today. Whatever is true about the future from here on in, however many years of relative safety and security we all have, whatever happens next, the thing we must do as a matter of life and death, as a matter of eternal life and eternal death, is to entrust our souls to God. That's the call. And here in chapter 4, some details about what that means and what that looks like. I just closed down this study of chapter 4 by pointing to the title that Peter chooses for God in verse 19. He could have called God anything. He could have just said, entrust your souls to God. But he chose this title, a faithful Creator. And I wonder if he chose that title just to further motivate us to get on with the business of entrusting our souls to God. He is our Creator. He is the absolute infinite expert on who we really are and what we're really made of and what sin has really done to us and what needs to happen to us next to free us more thoroughly from our sin and to make us more holy. He's our Creator. And He's never missed an opportunity to care for us. He's our faithful Creator. It's not just that He made us, so He's the expert. It's that He's faithful, so He can be trusted. So we ought to trust Him about every detail of our lives that makes us wonder about Him. We ought to just go ahead and entrust our souls to God, believing that God will give us the strength to do it. So we ought to get on with doing it. This is the word of God to us this morning. Let's pray.